James from Survival Punk, and I want to welcome back Paul Wheaton, the Duke of Permaculture. Paul, how are you?
I am large.
Large and in charge, right?
of some small things, perhaps.
Right. So what have you got going on, Paul?
We are currently under construction of Wolfati 0.8.
Awesome.
And probably next week we will complete Wolfati 0.7. So we built most of Wolfati 0.7 last year, and we never got a chance to put the umbrella on. And so now it's warm and dry and hot. It's even hot here. And so this is going to be a great time to put the umbrella on Wolfati 0.7 and finish that. So, but in the meantime, the roundwood timber framing of Wolfati 0.8 is well underway, and the walls are going up today.
Awesome. Is anyone taking pictures of that on the forums?
Oh, yeah. There's gobs of pictures on the forums of Permies.
Awesome.
If you go to the forum called Wheaton Laboratories, just packed right. with photos.
I'm going to have to check that out. I was hooked on the first Wolfati building. I was checking in at work and stuff just to see all the pictures going up.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And so, you know, of course, my brother and his family lived in it all through the winter last winter, but it was pretty much nothing because the umbrella wasn't on it. Then it's like nothing more than a log cabin with an earthen roof. So, which of course needed heat. It needed lots of heat. So,
yeah.
You know, there was a lot of wood burned to keep it warm. Now, hopefully we'll get the umbrella on it, and this year we'll be able to, this winter, hopefully it won't require heat. Hopefully.
All right. Well, didn't you say that, Tim's wife likes it 90 degrees, so...
Right, so there'll be two Wafatis, one for normal people, and one for the people who like it hot. Yeah.
Oh. Which, I'm gonna ask you something about staying hot later on, but let's go ahead and get into really what I want to talk to you about, and that's sort of how can common people get started with permaculture. And I don't, I know you talk about it a lot, and I do too, about bricks, you know, doing stuff over, you know, people that talk about it or whine and complain about other problems of just going and doing things. So I just want to talk about how people can get started in permaculture and just start actually making real changes.
Okay. It does seem like there's a lot of people between going to baseball games and football games and watching American Idol, that they do tend to find things that are bad, and they say they should do something about it. And that's about the extent of where they're at. But I also kind of feel like, you know, a lot of the things that we're doing, we're talking to people's wallets. And it's kind of like, hey, here's a tip. If you do this thing, it could save you $3,000 a year. You know, how about this thing over here? And it could save you $5,000. Or if you're going to build a new home, what about a Wolfati? And I hope to be able to prove that it could save you $50,000 in a new home and building a new home. And it's something you could do yourself. So so a lot of this stuff, I mean, so much of what we talk about, the value of reducing toxicity in your world is tied to energy. And energy has an almost direct attachment to dollars. And it's not always the case, but oftentimes it is. So when people want to go and build a straw bale house, then it's like, okay, it's going to cost you 30% more than a conventional home. And it's like, well, why is that? Well, there, you know, you would think that straw has no embedded energy, but actually running that straw baler does take some energy. And then, you know, because you don't happen to live in a place that's in the middle of a grain field, you don't have straw on site. And
right.
So you have to import it. And that's going to, again, use energy. And and because straw has a not so great insulative value, then you have to import a lot of it in order to be able to make a straw bale home. So it's just, but all right. So like the beginners, I do think that there's in the, when people get started down permaculture road, there's a couple of different approaches that they take. One is what I refer to as the Holmgrenian approach, so based on the works of David Holmgren. And the other one is going to be the Holzerian approach, based on the works of Sepp Holzer. And with the Holmgren approach, then it's like the world has a lot of problems, and I want to do something. I'm going to clean up my own personal act and be better, and then so it all comes from a perspective of like, what are the global problems? Then I'm going to do things within my own space to solve those problems. Now, and whereas the Holzerian approach is more like, hey, look at this. Here's a thing you can do, and it saves you money. And so then after you've done maybe 30 or 40 of these things, it turns out that you've kind of ended up doing the same things as if you'd started from a Holmgrenian approach. So, but you're not doing it because of saving the world. You're doing it because it probably saves you money. It's a way of going about things that just makes better sense. You get, you know, better returns on your investment, kind of a thing. So I guess where I'm going with this is to say, I started off saying that there's two different approaches. And while this thing about the Holmgren and the Holzer thing is kind of like, it's not the two, it's one of the two. So then the other aspect of it is it's like the whole wheat and eco-scale thing. And this is a thing that I made up. And because I made it up, I put my name on it, so that way it's not going to get confused with somebody else's scale. And also to say other people can make scales too. I just needed a tool in order to be able to describe something. So what I did is I said there are 6 billion people at level 0, 1 billion at level 1, 100 million at level 2, 10 million at level 3, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, until you get to level 10, and there's one person, and I'm going to say that that person is Sepp Holzer. So for this scale, then there's two major observations, and I believe that how people behave within this scale, which is the function of the scale, is inappropriate, and I want us to be better than that. But observation one, no matter where you are on the scale, you yourself, a person, wherever a person, everybody that's behind the generic you, behind you on the scale, is screwing things up. If they're just one level behind you, they're annoying. And if they're two levels behind you, then man, they're causing some real problems. And three levels behind you is like, oh, we got to stop those people. They're fucking up everything. We got to make laws against them and stuff like that. Now, remember, I'm saying this reaction is inappropriate.
Right.
Then the other side of it is a person that's one level ahead of you seems cool. A person two levels ahead seems really cool. A person three levels ahead seems crazy. And at four levels ahead, they seem so crazy that they should be institutionalized for their own safety and the safety of others around them. And again, inappropriate. But I think that it's important to say when we're talking about how do we get somebody started, what's the beginning, then I kind of feel like the thing to do is if they're at level zero, tell them about things at level one. Don't tell them about things that Sepp Holzer's doing. That's just going to sound crazy. So to them, and so talk about things that at level one, things that are like small little things that they can do. And then if somebody's at level three, you could tell them about things at level four and level five, and they'll be interested. But if you try to tell them about things at level six, then they'll just think it sounds crazy and they'll be turned off and they won't do it. So I guess the thing is for people that are starting out, there's some people that start out and they totally fall in love with the Holmgren approach. And it's like they've got the three ethics, they've got the 12 principles, and it's like this is the way that they want to live their life. Sometimes people that go down that path just kind of see like to get from A to B, to get from where they are to being a Holmgrenian approach, it seems like such a massive leap, they can't even think of where to begin and where to start, so they kind of get stuck. And I read a blog about a week or two ago where somebody said exactly that. It sounded like that they had embraced the ethics and the principles, and that they it sung to them, and this is how they want to live the rest of their life, is to these principles. But they couldn't. It's like they couldn't see a way to get from where they are to that, and so they were kind of feeling a little stuck. It's like there's too much of a chasm between where they are and where they want to be. And they said that they had listened to my podcast, and by listening to my podcast, then they were able to start making those baby steps and make progress. And then they made a little hugelkultur bed, then they made a bigger hugelkultur bed, and then they can start, you know, doing other things in their life. Which I think is kind of like, you know, so while they love the Holmgrenian approach, then it's a Holzerian approach that gets them to actually move towards the Holmgrenian set of ideals. Have I answered your question, or am I just babbling?
I think I like where you're going. So it seems to me like you're not too concerned with the ethics and the set rules that, you know, Holmgren and Mollison created, and you're more interested in, hey, go make a hugel bed and go plant this, and you have stuff, right?
Well, and the important thing is you're saying me, Paul, this is what I'm interested in. And I got to say that after traveling as far down permaculture road as I've traveled, I have to say that when – because I spend an enormous amount of time trying to persuade people to move further down permaculture road. And there are people out there that move further down permaculture road by studying the ethics and the principles. And that's what works for them. And they get stars in their eyes, and they're very dreamy, and they really want to do this. But I find that for most people, I can get farther by talking about a thing. So like today I put out an article about 20 ways to stay cooler and really save energy in the summer. And so I think that probably 70% of the United States population would find this to be of interest. And they'd like, oh, it's a short thing. I'll look at it real quick and see if there's anything in there that that interests me, that, you know, I want to do. And whereas I think that if you start talking about, you know, hey, you should live better by studying permaculture, and here's the ethics and the principles, I think that there are people that would love that even more than my article about, you know, 20 ways. But they're a smaller audience.
Right.
And so it's different. I think that it depends. There you go. Whew.
It depends.
The answer to all things in permaculture. It depends. It depends on the person. I'm at a point now where I've kind of gotten this horrible reputation, and I don't know if it's horrible by my standards, but horrible by the standards of many permaculture people, that I'm a horrible person by their standards, because I avoid talking about the ethics and the principles. And frankly, when it comes to like trying to make things better, like something's not working or something's less than optimal, then it's like, oh, let's roll out the principles and the ethics, and then we will, you know, apply these to this problem, and then that'll make the solution obvious. And so far, I haven't seen that ever happen. But what I have seen happen is something like, you know, hey, let's do this thing, and it turns out we get three benefits from that thing. So that's stacking functions, one of the principles. Yay! So I have seen that happen, which is not quite the same thing. It's like, you know, so you get to a problem, it's like, oh, how can we bring stacking functions into this? I don't know. it's like, so does this make sense? I think if you present people with a bunch of techniques, then it's like then they know it's in their head, and then they get to a problem, and it's like, oh, you know, this one time I remember hearing about this thing that you could do, Hoogle culture, and then you do the Hoogle culture and it does these things. How about if we do that? Yeah, that would stack functions too, wouldn't it? It totally would. Now they're moving forward. So, you know, and then some people say, well, permaculture is not just a collection of techniques. And they're right. Permaculture is not just a collection of techniques. At the same time, I think when getting people to go from zero to starting, then I think that we see a great deal more progress by introducing them to the techniques.
That's kind of the divide that I see, and I'm way more interested in techniques. I want to know how. I'm terrible about I don't know. I don't want to say studying things, but sometimes I'll get the gist of it, and I'd rather just go try it. And if I mess it up, then I'm like, oh well, I found out how it doesn't work. Instead of and I guess the ethics and some of the stuff like Jack talks about is a hang up for me where I just want to know how to do it and then look at the results and see how it goes over hear about, you know, how doing it can make the world a better place. Because I know, you know, if I grow a bunch of food, then the earth is going to be happier and the people are going to be happier. But I just want to do it. And it seems like a lot of the nuts and bolts, people can't get to the nuts and bolts. And that's where I think they need to be going.
I think another thing is like, cause you know, some of us are very concerned about the world as a whole. And I think a lot of our concern about world problems is dominantly like it makes our own lives scary and unsafe. And it's like somebody else is pooping in my drinking water or somebody else is putting toxic stuff into the air and I'm breathing that air. And so it's like I want safety for myself. I want safety for my family. I want safety for the people I care about. And those guys are making things unsafe. So we keep talking about like save the world and do what's best for the world and stuff like that. But a lot of times, and some people are like, you know, fuck environmentalists.
Yeah.
And it's like I don't really understand that mentality because it's like I'm going to fucking poison the air as much as I fucking want. And it's kind of like, dude, aren't you breathing that same air? You know? And so it's kind of like there's a little bit of like, you know, what about the rest of us, man? You're poisoning the air for the rest of us. I mean, if you want to poison your own air but not poison ours, I suppose I have a hard time arguing with that, except that you could be making a mess, which does affect all of us no matter how hard you try not to. But I think, and granted, I also get a lot of people that speak out against me because I speak out against some things that are claimed to be on behalf of environmentalists. And it's kind of like I kind of, as I take a thing apart, it's like, what environmentalist said this? They say, this is supposed to be good for the environment. Who said that? What environmentalist said that? This is toxic. This is terrible. This is not environmentally friendly. And so then some people who believe in what they were told, then they're angry at me. And so I kind of feel like I've been named by some organizations as being hardcore green. You know, the environmentalist, and stuff like that. So I kind of feel like I'm taking this to a super higher level in a way, which kind of makes people who already hate environmentalists hate me more. And then it makes people who love environmentalists hate me more. So bring it on.
I kind of don't get how, well, I have the same problem. I meet a lot of people that say they're just not into survivalism. And it just makes me think, are you a nihilist? I just don't get that. Like, I can understand you not being into parts of it, but anyone that doesn't care to survive as a person, then that's just stupid. And this is the same thing with environmentalism. Like, You want to go around and like pollute the air with stuff? It's going to kill you too, you idiot.
Right. I think that it's fair for a person to hate environmentalists when environmentalists supposedly are espousing things that are not good for the environment. And it's right. Kind of like, I get that. I mean, it's like, you know, and I think that the people that are hating on the environmentalists as a general group, I think that those guys have some very valid points. And at the same time, I think that there are a lot of things that some environmentalists are advocating which are correct. And then there's even this whole thing of like two environmentalists are arguing with each other apparently, and it turns out that one of them is totally not an environmentalist. They're just saying that because they want to like leverage the word environmentalist. You know, and so, oh, we all want to do what's good for the environment. Well, it turns out you don't really. And so I've been kind of going around and I've been finding some of these people and I've been saying, by the power vested in me as the Duke of Permaculture and whatever other authority that I have, I'm saying, no, you're not an environmentalist. I hereby take away your license to call yourself an environmentalist. Stop it. You're a destructionist. You're just icky.
Yeah.
You're making life suck for the rest of us. Shut the fuck up. So, and so of course people don't like me for that either. All right. So, but from a survivalist perspective, it's kind of like, here's a big thing. There's many aspects to survival stuff. And I am certainly not an expert on survival stuff. However, let's take a quick look at a couple of things. Let's suppose you explore the kind of environmentalism like I can go out into the woods with my bug out bag and I can live in the woods for the rest of my life. Now let's say that you got your bug out bag and then you got all the junk in your head to make that work out and to make that statement true. The important thing is that with that bug out bag and that knowledge in your head, when you go to your day job during the day, you go there because you want to, not because you have to. By having that bug out bag and that knowledge, you have now shifted your relationship with your job from a have to a want to. And that is huge. Life, the air you breathe is far more delicious. Life is better. Everything is good because now you don't have to go to work anymore. You go there because you choose to. You want the money to use it for something, you know? And so quality of life has just gone up by an order of magnitude just from having that knowledge. And I think that's a very important thing.
Right.
Then you want to start talking about survival stuff as far as like being self-sufficient. Can you have a bug out spot? Or, and I think that when you start considering all the things that are scary, and you want to have a life where you don't have to worry about scary things, I think that the destination always is the same, permaculture plus homesteading. And so basically you choose to live at your, like live full time at your bug out location. And so you're going to put in your hugelkultur beds and your food systems there. And I've even been to some people where it's like they're living at their property. They're doing, But what they're kind of doing is they want to build permaculture systems, but they want to still go and eat at restaurants all the time. And they want to use the refrigerator and their freezer and, you know, eat delivery pizza and that kind of thing. And what they've done is that they've planted this food forest and it's like all of the deer are coming by and eating the food forest. And their position is that they're going to eat only the foods that they really, really like, and they're going to live this rich, luxuriant life. And if things go wonky, then they've got a plan B, complete with venison.
It's a good plan B.
And I was kind of thinking, like, you know, that's actually a really smart way to go to it, because a lot of people go down homesteading road, and they get really burnt out. You know, they've got, like, chickens and hogs and dairy cattle and beef cattle. And, you know, so they've got all these food systems in place and they're, they're going through and they're caring for their food forest to get the food out and do all the canning and everything. And, you know, it's a lot of work. Now, granted, for a lot of people, it's not work. It is loving life. And then it's like, you know, you have a quality of food that's an order of magnitude better than what you can buy that's labeled organic. And so you've got this better food and you know exactly what went into it, what went on. And then on top of that, it's for a fraction of the cost. So, they've got this improved life, and that's a way to go, but it's not for everybody. For some people, I like this alternative of, you know, keep living life your way you want. You've got your plan B ready to go. And, so what if the deer eat it? Keep the deer around. They're beautiful animals. It's fun to watch. And then, if things go wonky, then, they're walking right up and it's easy to harvest. And if you're hungry and those restaurants aren't available anymore and pizza place doesn't deliver anymore, then, well, you got your plan B food right here.
I like that a lot. Yeah. I find it neat that a lot of the hobbies and stuff that I'm interested in tend to all converge towards like a certain area. So like survivalism took me to permaculture, and my desire to eat good foods is going to lead me. The only way to make what I want to eat sustainable is to have a homestead. Cause I want to eat good quality meat, good quality organic foods. And it just seems like that's pushing me towards a homestead with chickens and pigs for my bacon every single day and eggs.
I think even beyond that, I mean, you know, right now, I mean, so like one of the things that I think is very scary for a lot of people is, what if I get cancer? You know, then what happens? I mean, that's a very scary thought to have, especially if you've got somebody that you know that's gone down that path. And it's like, well, let me answer the question with another question. What if permaculture food cures cancer? You know,
I really believe that too. I wholeheartedly believe that nutrition is a huge factor, if not even the like sole reason people have cancer out of control. Like there'd be a small portion, like just random, but the rest of it's just people eat toxic food every single day.
I think toxins, I mean, many toxins are carcinogens, but then it's like for all the things that we figured out, these things are carcinogens. I think for each one of those things, I'll bet there's 100 other things which we haven't figured out they're carcinogens yet.
Right.
You know, or that they're even toxins and possibly not carcinogenic toxins, but some other kind of toxin. And so I'm more concerned about the things we haven't figured out yet than the things that we have. And now granted, in nature, there's things that are toxic as well as carcinogenic. And I think we need to be wary in that space too. So it's not limited to just, you know, the things that are manufactured. But at the same time, I like the idea that someday there could be 10,000 little farms, for lack of a better word, farms throughout the United States that are each, you know, permaculture based, and a person with cancer could show up at one of those and then find out, you know, just see, just you've got cancer, you're supposed to be dead in 4 months, you show up, you sit down, you hang out for a week, you eat the food that's there, and then maybe it goes away. Maybe you arrive in a wheelchair and you leave without the wheelchair.
Right.
So I think that based on what little I know, I think it's not only plausible, but I think it's a done deal. All that's left to do is to just utterly prove it. We just need to build such a mass of anecdotal evidence that it's worthy of trying to take the next step into, like, you know, let's do some double blind studies and the like.
Right.
So, but first we need to build up that anecdotal evidence pool.
Yeah. I don't know if you've seen it, but there was a documentary I watched on Netflix about, I think his name was Dr. Gershom.
Is this, The Beautiful Truth?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. What was his record? Was it something like he treated 1,000 people with cancer and cured, I think, 1,000 or like 999 of them?
Well,
with an organic diet?
I think that the important thing is that as part of the story in that movie, they were talking about threats that he got, and then how the AMA, you know, said he's a quack, and then they eventually destroyed all of his records were stolen,
right?
And which of course then the people on the other side, the AMA, they're like, he's a quack. Look, he says that his records are stolen, but you know, were they really? I mean, you know, he never had the evidence, and so he's just saying they're stolen. So it's like there's this. So bottom line is it's like I think it's up to people to decide for themselves whether, you know, this guy is a quack or is there something real going on there. Now, not only do I have a podcast that I recorded reviewing that, and in fact I reviewed it with my friend Helen Attow, and in fact the day before, which we do not reveal in the podcast, but the day before. Helen called me while she was in the parking lot after having been told that she has breast cancer.
Oh.
And she's like, what am I going to do? And she'd already been scheduled for surgery and chemo and all that stuff. They'd already planned it all out for her. And I said, well, okay, you know what? I want you to come to my house. We're going to watch this movie. We'll do a podcast review of the movie. So she basically did not – do surgery and chemo, and instead went with a more permaculture approach to living her life. I fished through her stuff in her house, and I found things that I believed were toxic vectors, and we got rid of those. And then she started eating things that were, I believe, less toxic, and it went away. So, the lump was gone, the cancer was gone. And we made a podcast about that. So it's a podcast with her and I talking about her cancer, finding out she has cancer, and then how, you know, the changes that she went through in her life to get rid of it and stuff like that. And then it's gone. So this isn't the only story of that. I mean, that's kind of the brutal thing is that, I would say there's millions of stories like that. I mean, the number of stories we just have on Permies alone is huge. And the number of people who contact me privately is huge. And the reason why they contact me privately is because they say it's bizarre how much shaming there is about this. And it's like, in fact, I originally posted some stuff where I'd been told by some people that they beat cancer without, you know, the system. And without the modern healthcare industry, and so I shared that information, and I got, I don't know, 5 or 6 emails from people saying the AMA says that guy is a quack, or how dare you get people's false hopes up, you know, and misleading them into quackery. So I took it down for a year, and then after a year, I thought, fuck this shit. No, I'm going to be bold. I'm going to stand up, and I'm going to say, you know, this is fully qualified information. You know, this isn't a guarantee that it'll make cancer go away. This is a path. And there are people that think that this path worked for them. Granted, this is nothing more than a pile of anecdotal evidence, but it's your choice. And, you know what? It's like we don't have proof that this alternative path solved Helen's cancer problem. We don't have proof of that. It could have just gone away on its own, just as mysteriously as it showed up. And, you know, and that really, this is the core of it. Human beings, people, believe that when they get cancer, it's like the cancer fairy showed up and went, ting, you have cancer. Yeah. Deal with it. And that's where cancer comes from, the cancer fairy. No one, when people get cancer, they don't like, well, how the fuck did you get it? Where did it come from? They don't ask those questions. They just assume it came from the cancer fairy. It was just, oh, I was chosen. Damn.
Yeah.
Bad luck. That's all it is, bad luck. No, no. Cancer comes from carcinogens. And granted, some people have a genetic disposition for it, but and that plays a role. But it's like, you know, my understanding, and I talked to a guy who worked in cancer research for decades, and in fact, I've talked to at least two guys who worked in cancer research for decades, and they both said the same thing. Everybody in the world has cancer all the time. Everybody. Always. The moment you're born, you got cancer. Everybody has it all the time. And then your immune system keeps it in check. But then if you start to bombard your world with so many carcinogens, and at the same time your immune system gets weaker and weaker and weaker, eventually your immune system can't keep up. So part of, you know, your immune system gets weaker as you get older. So that's part of it. That's why old people tend to get cancer easier than young people. But like, let's take a good hard look at the numbers of children getting cancer. And it's like, we had, and I believe it was in 1950, we had one pediatric oncology practice in the United States. One. So that's children's cancer. We had one place to deal with children's cancer. Now there's like over 400. And so it's kind of like, you know, that's got to give you some numbers. That's got to give you some idea. So, okay, well, granted, here's Darwin's theory at work. These kids are going to die of cancer and they're not going to reproduce. And whoever, you know, does reproduce, they're going to be less susceptible to cancer, I suppose. But that's a way of looking at it. Let's breed in a population that's able to cope with this level of toxicity we're requiring to live in. Sure, that's a way to do it, I suppose. I would have to say that if it was my kids, my friends, my family, I would want to take them out of that toxic environment. All right. Your position had to do with survivalism. And I kind of believe that, you know, do you not want to survive cancer? Is this one of the things that we want to survive? Is this one of the things that are the scary things? And for myself, I just kind of feel like when you start to look into politics, or you start to read the newspaper, or you start to find out about these diseases, including cancer, political decisions that are being made, where it's like you really don't seem to have much influence, and it kind of seems like it's all about like you know, doing things that are contrary to what seems like the right thing, then you kind of start to think, how can I have a place where I am more removed from that, and where a place where I can be healthier, a place, you know, we watched here at Wheaton Labs last night. We got Wednesday night is movie night, and last night we watched one of the Dick Prenicky movies. And then it's got Dick Prenicky, and he's the Alone in the Wilderness guy, the guy that goes up in the wilderness, builds his own cabin in 10 days, and all with hand tools. And it's an amazing, amazing movie. I'm sure all of your listeners have already watched this 5 times.
Yeah.
But this is like, there's apparently a series of 4 DVDs, and last night we watched DVD number 3, and in it, it's like, oh, here's Dick Prenicky, and he's like 75 years old. He's never been sick. Never. Not once.
I mean, oh, wow.
He's living up there in Alaska by himself, and he's never been sick. He's living in a log cabin that he built. And he's never been sick, never even had a cold.
Wow.
And it's kind of like, is it because he just happens to have this powerful immune system, or is it because his immune system is being able to easily deal with the little things that come up all the time, because it's not being perpetually overwhelmed? All right. I should pause for a moment, give you a chance to ask the next question or more questions on that space or something. I don't know. I got on a little bit of a rant there. I'm done. I'm backing off.
I like that. And then right towards the end, you sort of – when you were talking about people finding a place to go to get away from the toxic gig, you actually led into my next question, which is on people trying to find land, which I know you just found land, and then I'm actually currently looking for land.
Okay.
So, tips, tricks, what to look for, any funny stories you had on your path to finding land.
Well, you can find land really easily if you've got $5 million. Then it's a piece of
cake.
Man.
Yeah.
Yes. And you got to have it, like, in your pocket when you show up. You know, it's like,
right.
Well, I've got $5 million right here. Is that going to be acceptable? Yes. Okay. Well, then I guess this is my land now. Then I've spent 3.5 years trying to find land this last go. I mean, I used to have 80 acres about 10 years ago, but so on this particular search, I wanted something much better. I wanted to be more particular. And the thing is that since I did not have millions of dollars, let alone I didn't even have $1 million, then it's kind of like, all right, well, you know, I'm going to have to sacrifice some of my criteria. And so I want to be able to optimize this path. I managed to find some land there are a couple of sacrifices with this piece of land, but the upsides vastly outweigh the downsides. So it all, you know, I'm happy with my purchase and I didn't spend $1 million to get it. But naturally the one thing that everybody knows, and which is why this particular variety of land is so expensive, is you want south facing slope. And,
right.
Once you have south-facing slope, especially in a place like Montana, everything's a little bit warmer. So there's step one. And then yet the piece of land that I bought is dominantly north-facing. Now, granted, it's got some flattish spots, some roly-poly in it and things like that. And there are like less than 1% of the land is actually south-facing. And then when we did the plot where we did the earthworks for the lemon tree outdoors in Montana, we actually used an excavator to create south facing slope. So we kind of have our south facing slope spot, even though it's not actually, you know, wasn't actually originally a south facing slope patch. South-facing slope is good. You know, you might think that one of the things I really wanted was something that had a year-round creek going through it, just because I want to be able to sit on my own land and put a line in the water and pull out a fish.
Nice.
And but there's problems with that in the United States. And I've got, you know, so like if there's this creek, let's say, and let's say this creek originally went in one place, and it meandered around an area, then the Army Corps of Engineers came in and said, oh, that's hurting real estate prices, so here's what we're going to do. We're going to dig a ditch that's a straight line and force all that water to run through this straight ditch. And now fish can't breed in it anymore, but apparently that's for the good. So there's a creek that runs through the land. That's a straight shot and the water runs pretty fast. But, if it goes through this million acre, you know, ranch or something, then, laws will get passed to say that, you know, you have to do these things with riparian areas, you know, unless of course you have lawyers, then we're not going to take that on. But if you're a small farmer with 10 acres, and that same – so like if a creek runs through your 10 acres and before it gets to your 10 acres, it goes through this million-acre ranch property where the guy's got lawyers and he's totally just got 10,000 cows standing in the creek shitting in it all day, then by the time it hits your property, then, you know, you've got 10 acres, but because it runs through the middle of your property, you only are allowed to play on 2 of your acres – because the rest of your land is designated as riparian area, which, you know, needs to grow big trees and shrubs and stuff to make sure that the creek stays clean and cool.
Huh.
And these can't be things, you don't get to use this area other than to appreciate the beauty of the creek. And then, like, let's say then the downstream of you is another place where, they've got lawyers. And so then they've again just devastated what comes out anyway. So it doesn't matter. But because you don't have expensive lawyers that they'll take on, then, you know, they'll come and look at your property and just say, it, you know, you can't use 8 of your 10 acres. So now I've heard from a lot of farmers that are in this conundrum and they don't know what to do. So it's like you're thinking to yourself, I'm going to get myself 10 acres of little creek running through it. And it's kind of like, you know, that might not be the best thing. That Now, on the other hand, you know, using permaculture techniques, there's a variety of things that we can do to make it so that you don't need irrigation. And in fact, we can even get there to be water flow when there is no water flow. And so, you know, which case you've created water flow artificially. And when you have an artificial water flow, then that's not the same thing as something where it's a creek. It's an existing creek. So there is no riparian zone. You do whatever you want to with that. And so that's what I ended up doing. I bought land that does not have water flowing on it. And so any water that ends up flowing on it comes from whatever I've done as a permaculturalist. And, you know, so they don't get to count it as a riparian area. It's an artificial flow.
I've heard you talk about that, and I think mentioned that you were going to make a creek on your land.
Yeah.
Can you dig into that a little bit? Because that just kind of that amazes me that you could make a creek on your land.
Well, let's. I mean, first of all, you know, if there's a creek already there, it probably came from a spring, and but it's possible the spring ran underground. And so then let's suppose for a moment that what you do is you make a pond near the spring, and then you make it so that when the spring flows, rather than heading for underground, it stays above ground.
Right.
I mean, that's pretty easy, right? That didn't take much. Okay. So as with many things in permaculture, it's not like there's just one way of doing this. There's like maybe a dozen ways we've come up with so far. And these ways are oftentimes the ways that nature does stuff. And it's like, all right, so, you know, how do we emulate nature, or how do we encourage nature to do more of this? So, I mean, basically I could probably talk for a couple of hours over these kinds of techniques, but there I've laid out one for you. If you have a spring, which a lot of properties do have a spring. You know, we don't have a spring on, I don't have a spring on my property, but, you know, we've got some things we're going to hopefully try this year, although, our excavator is currently sort of offline for any kind of digging that I want to do. So we'll have to try again possibly next year. Did I answer your question well enough? Did you want to talk more?
Yes, no, you're good. And then you keep mentioning in your answers what I want to ask you next. If I knew I didn't send you the outline, I would think you snuck it somehow. So next, I kind of want to touch base on the lemon tree in Montana that you keep talking about.
All right.
How are you going to grow a lemon tree in Montana? How are you going to do that?
All right. Along the lines of, first of all, let's just say Sepp Holzer is growing lemon trees outdoors in the Alps of Austria. So, and it gets to be about 20 below there. So,
okay.
Let's just be clear. A can be done. Now, granted, citrus typically cannot tolerate freezing temperatures. And so then it's like, you know, the first thing to do is understand, well, why? Why are you such a wimpy plant? But let's take it a little bit further. And let's explore some of the things that Sepulcher's doing. And I mean, like, as I was just talking about for that other technique, it's like, no, there's a, I mean, there's like 2 hours of stuff to talk about just there, and then we're just getting warmed up. But,
oh, wow.
But it's like, let's talk about a couple of quick things. One is, let's say we build a hugelkultur bed that is a straight line, and it goes east to west. So that means that the sun will hit the south side, and it will not very often hit the north side. Is that accurate?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Now, let's suppose it's got fairly steep sides. So when the sun is low in the winter, that hugelkultur bed is collecting the sun pretty well. And in which case, is it possible that the south-facing side of that hugelkultur bed is 10 degrees warmer than, say, flat land? Possible.
Sounds accurate.
Okay.
Yeah,
all right.
Possible.
All right. So now we've got one thing. And that buys us a little bit. Now what if we put it into a sun scoop shape? So we've kind of made a shape that's something of a parabola. So that way, the sun hits it and it's directly south, it collects it one way. But as the sun traverses the sky in the wintertime, then it hits different parts of the parabola, which then will absorb some of the heat, but will also reflect some of the heat to other parts of this sun scoop shape. So anything that's reflected ends up being caught by a different part within this sun scoop shape. So maybe we've gone from it being 10 degrees warmer to being 15 degrees warmer. Sound all right so far?
All right.
Now, I want to take what you just heard and the conclusions you drew. Now I'm going to go down to Coquille, Oregon, where I have a video on YouTube about Cobbville. So this is this place where Yonto Evans has built a bunch of Cobb structures, including this curvy, beautiful Cobb wall. And it turns out that with this curvy Cobb wall, there's a spot where there's kind of a sun scoop shape, but it's a vertical wall, a dark colored vertical wall that faces the south. And so it's a curved shape. And he says in the video that they've measured it. They've measured at points inside the wall and out on the flat land, and they found that the stuff inside this curved wall is 30 degrees warmer.
Wow.
All right. So I think that's a lot. That's pretty warm.
Yeah.
Now, the cool thing is that with a curved shape like that, and it's a vertical wall, then in the summertime, it's not going to be all that much warmer because the sun's passing directly overhead. And so the sun scoop shape really isn't going to do much of anything. But then when the sun is low in the sky, now that wall is going to really collect the heat. And since it's a cob wall that's 18 inches thick, it's going to hold that heat, and a dark colored cob wall. It's going to really hold that heat, and it's going to, you know, release it back the next day also, especially since it's dry. It's not wet because there's a little roof over it keeping it dry.
Oh.
All right. So
okay.
He says he's measured it 30 degrees warmer. All right. So now we've gotten a little further along. Now, this will be the last thing I'll share right now, but let's suppose that we put a little pond a little bit to the south of this spot. So now the sun is low and it's heating up that sun scoop shape, but there's also sunlight hitting the pond, which is reflecting up and hitting the sun scoop shape.
Ah.
Double sun.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not going to say that it's going to raise the temperature, you know, to be 60 degrees warmer, but let's say it gives you another 5 degrees. So we go from 30 degrees to 35 degrees. Well, now we've made it so that something that will not, just through these things, just through this list so far, it's plausible. I'm not saying it's an absolute fact, but I'm saying it's plausible that this area can be 35 degrees warmer, which takes you from 32 degrees to 0 degrees. So something that can that won't tolerate freezing temperatures at all can now tolerate temperatures, and you know, where the general area is down to 0 degrees. In theory, maybe not entirely true. There's a lot of other variables. Maybe a bigger wall. Maybe, you know, a bigger sun scoop shape, etc. But we're just getting started. I mean, there's lists upon lists upon lists of things that we can do, and we start adding these things up, and each one. So, in fact, the 35 degree thing, maybe if you have like 2 weeks of cloudy weather and really cold weather, then maybe instead of buying 35 degrees, we've only bought 15 degrees. But hey, if you can buy 15 degrees, can't you buy 15 more? Can't you just start, you know, adding all these things up and come up with more and more and more? So, and then for us, I mean, it can, we got down to 26 below. So like, let's say it gets as cold as 30 below here. That means we need to find a way to buy roughly 60 degrees. And once we've bought 60 degrees, then we can get this to all work out.
Awesome. You've already put in the work for this in your World Domination DVD set?
That's right. We've got the World Domination Gardening DVD set, which is now available. And you can go to permies.com/WDG. And that's where, you know, you can get it. And in that we show the earthworks for this. And we talk about, you know, we talk about a lot of the stuff, how to make things warmer in the winter times and cooler in the summertime. Because half, you know, this originally started, the stuff in the DVD, I mean, basically it's just a DVD of a workshop. And so we started off the workshops in the San Diego area. So pretty damn warm. And one of the problems is that they have is that it's hard to grow anything there because it gets so hot in the summer.
Right.
So we wanted to make areas that would be much cooler in the summertime. But in the particular location we were at, they also experienced frost in the wintertime. So we wanted to also make some spots that would be warmer in the winter. But we talk about that in the video. We go into a lot of detail about some of the different structures we make. I mean, one of the things that we did about the lemon tree site in Montana is that we built the sun scoop shape, and around that we built a much bigger sun scoop. So we've got the little one that's like 6 feet tall. It's a sun scoop shape. And then we've got the one that's 15 feet tall outside of that. And the function of that one is that to be a berm, and we want to block the wind. We're not going to block the wind completely, but we're going to reduce it dramatically. And because wind is cooling and desiccating. So we want to be able to have it be a little bit moister and a little bit warmer. And by building this large berm, I mean, there's other benefits to building the berm as well. But by building this large berm, it helps to reduce the wind in the immediate vicinity. And so it's going to be a little warmer.
Awesome. Which kind of leads me into my next question, which you've already talked about. Can you share a few of the big tips you got on the staying cool in summer?
I would say that the number one tip is to plant a big tree. Like plant something that will grow to be 150 feet tall. And now a lot of people are kind of feeling like, oh, no, you can't plant that near my house. It'll, you know, fall over and crush my house. And it's like, well, you know, that's part of the risk, and there's ways to mitigate that risk. But the thing is that if you go under tree, like it's a really hot day, wow, it's 95 degrees outside, and you've got this tree that is just this uber giant tree that's 100, 150 feet tall, and you go under this tree, it is dramatically cooler. Now, if you've got another tree that's like 15 feet tall and you go into the shade of that tree, it's cooler, but it's not as cool as the giant tree. And so the thing is that let's suppose that your house is surrounded by these trees and even shaded by this tree. And it's like, let us suppose for a moment that it's 20 degrees cooler under the tree. Isn't it going to be 20 degrees cooler in your house? I mean, that's pretty simple. Now, of course, granted, planting a tree, it could take, you know, a decade or two until that tree's doing that work for you. But a lot of permaculture solutions involve trees. Trees are this amazing thing, which, you know, you go and you visit somebody's house and they're in a desert area and they have no trees at all in their yard, and their air conditioning bill is something like $400 a month. And that's to make it tolerable in their house, right. Not even really comfortable. And it's kind of like, you know, first step, I would plant a bunch of trees that have the potential to grow really, really giant. So there's that. I think another one that isn't a very – I mean, there are things that are well known, like, oh, when it's cool at night, you open up the windows, and then when it starts to get warm during the day, you close all the windows. I think that one's a really well-known one. But let's talk about a couple that are not really well-known. One of them is to add layers of shade on your house. So if you've got some eaves that hang off your house by a foot and a half, say, which is moderately typical,
right?
You could hang stuff like sheets or burlap or something. And granted, I'm not trying to make it beautiful, although I think a person could make it be attractive.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is that if you just create a layer of shade around your house, because when the sun hits your walls, now when your windows open up, it's going to, you know, it's hot immediately outside your windows. But if you just add this layer of shade, that cools your house. And it's like not as great as a massive, massive tree, but it's using some of the same principles. Another one, which I think is mentioned often, but maybe not everybody's heard of it, is to vent out your attic space. So a lot of houses will have a conventional roof of some type, and then there'll be this space in there that's like 3.5 feet tall that you can kind of crawl through or whatever. But in the summertime, it'll be 140 degrees up there.
Right.
And if you just simply add a vent up there, it's amazing how much cooler your entire house becomes. But I think that one's pretty well documented. But let's talk about another one that's kind of a little bit crazy.
I like crazy.
Okay. It's going to look crazy. It's going to sound crazy. It's crazy, but it really is effective. And that is grow a garden on your roof. And so then I imagine most people are thinking like, yeah, I can't do that. I've got, you know, 3-tab roof with slope. You know, you can't be putting shit on that. And it's like, oh, contraire. So it's been done. And what people have done is they've set up a framework that sits on top of the 3-tab roof. And then they've got like this massive network of container gardening systems that they do up there. And they do something in such a way that it fits within the load limits of what the roof can deal with. And the thing is that the container gardening system that's up there on your roof is something that not only is the soil inside the container, which is wet, relatively cool, which then cools your roof, but just the container itself or the wooden shelf it's sitting on that's been properly mounted on your roof casts a level of shade onto your roof, which then cools the entire roof. And of course, now you got a little garden on your roof and it just looks really cool. But, you know, we want to add layers of shade around the entire house. And it's like what you want to do is you want to have something that is something that will shade your roof. It's really that simple. If you could just add this whole other layer over your house of shade, that would provide a significant improvement. And then on top of that, like let's say you went out and you just bought a massive roll of burlap fabric and it cost you, I don't know, $250. And then you needed to put together some sort of cheesy framework to set it on to just shade your house. And granted, it's going to, it's going to do mediocre in a windstorm. And it might only last a year, but it's like, it might be able to cut your air conditioning bill by a factor of three, just that alone. And it costs, maybe you spent $500 in this stuff, which could be potentially used for several years during the hottest times of the year. And it's like, but it'll probably, you know, earn its keep in what, 2 months?
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then on, and that's just one thing, And granted, you will look like the crazy person on the block, but if it works. And then the other thing is like, here's one other thing. During the hottest part of the day, you could go out and spritz it with a bit of water. And that'll help to cool your house. All right. So there's a couple of crazy ideas for you, just to kind of get you started on things that are a little unusual for cooling your house. And the thing I wrote has a list of 20, and I'm sorry, I don't have it memorized.
That's fine. I'm going to – right before I called you, I got the Dailyish email, and I was like, made a mental note to read that later. I'm in an apartment that's south-facing with huge windows in the living room and the bedroom. And it gets pretty toasty. I mean, it helps out in the wintertime. Following some of your things, I haven't used heat at all in my apartment for the past 3 years. But the summer gets pretty toasty. So I'm definitely looking for things to cool it down in here.
Layers of shade. You know, so is there any way that you can hang something outside of your apartment?
I could try. They're pretty laid back. I mean, for about 2 years, I had raised bed gardens out my window, and then eventually they came in and yanked them out, which really perturbed me. But I could try, and I doubt they'd say anything, at least for a while.
Yeah. I mean, if you could add a layer of shade outside and then add another layer of shade inside, that'll make a dramatic difference right there. And so, I mean, basically, you think about it, when the sun's hitting the stuff that's outside of your apartment, then it's cooking it. It's raising the temperature of it. I mean, like, you go out there and you touch it, and it's too hot to touch. Maybe 140 yeah. degrees, maybe 150 degrees. And so rather than that being 140 degrees, I mean, think about it, that 140 degrees is conducting into your living space. And so that's not helping. And then plus the air now immediately outside, instead of being something like, I don't know, 85 or 90, which is the ambient temperature surrounding your apartment, it's going to be something like 120 because it's been doing all this solar collection.
Right.
So just by having that single layer of shade out there is going to dramatically cool your space.
I would definitely have to try that. I don't like paying huge electric bills.
What's next, James?
Let's see. I just have one more. I just got one more little thing, and then we'll let you talk about whatever you got coming up, and then I'll let you go and get back to doing stuff.
All right.
So. And this is just sort of a parting sort of funny question. Since I've got into survivalism and permaculture and primitive skills and stuff, I've met a lot of hippies over the past couple years. And they seem to be sort of divided into like two camps. Either like the best people you'll ever meet and you just love them right away, or just really sort of, mean and just condescending. And I know from some of the stuff that you've talked about, you've bumped into a few hippies yourself. Do you have any funny anecdotes about
about hippies?
Yeah, about hippies.
I still kind of struggle a little bit with whether or not I myself am a hippie. I do know the hippies have made it pretty clear that I'm not included. And so I seem not hippie to hippies, and then to the rest of the world, maybe I seem a little hippie-ish. I'm not sure. But I do think that the if you try to break all the hippies down into two categories, I believe that that's an opportunity for God to come and show you that he can make more categories. And because God, Voltaire said, God is a comedian playing before an audience that's afraid to laugh. And I really like that. I think Voltaire is a sharp guy. And I think that, yeah, so the moment that you say there's two kinds and you break them down like that, then the comedian within God is going to come down and like say, oh, dude, I have got an awesome joke for you. And watch what I'm going to send your way. So I think that every person on the planet comes with a bucket of psychology, and which is a euphemism for a bucket of crazy. So I think everybody's got their own oddball thing going on, and some oddball things are closer to my flavor of oddball, that they seem less nutty, I guess. We do have a lot of, it's like, you know, I manage these forums, these permaculture forums. We get about 1 million people each month talking about permaculture at permies.com. And I'd say that the flavor of hippie that's a problem for us is the folks that I call the hate in the name of love crowd. And these are the people that say that you should love everybody unconditionally. And then their actions are that they hate people. And, you know, so these are our biggest – they're big, big haters. But they seem to talk a lot about how you should love everybody unconditionally all day long, you know, without exception. And I've met some people that are like, you should love everybody unconditionally all the time. And they really do it, and they're amazing people, and it is a it is definitely a school of thought for those with more strength of character than I have myself, and and I really respect these people, and it's beautiful to just see the buckets of crazy that they encounter and how they roll with it, and that's different than the people that we seem to have a lot of, And in fact, when I gave my keynote speech this last March, one of the things I said is, like, here's the phrases that are now cringeworthy, which you would think would not be. But now that we've had so much time with these forums at Permies, when we see these phrases come up, it makes us cringe. And it's like, you know, you're kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop. And so just as a – along these lines, one of them is namaste. When I first heard this phrase, namaste, it kind of seemed like something where it was like, you know, some foreign thing and it's meant to be a lovely thing. And then I got to the point where I thought namaste means I'll be back to fuck up your shit later. And I looked it up. Just before giving my keynote to see what it really meant. And it says, and it's supposed to mean, I bow to the divine in you. And, but it's like, whenever I hear it anymore, I mean, maybe there's other countries in the world where they say it all the time. And these are really, truly lovely people. But now it sends a shiver down my spine because I think that that person's going to be one of the hate in the name of love people. They're going, I mean, I'm just so used to it now that I cringe, and I'm worried that, oh, watch this person. They're going to come back and do something horrible soon. And so then it's that's an example of it. That's so in the world of hippies. And it's like, you know, I got to tell you that some of the most wonderful experiences of my life have been like hippie events. And I just so love going, and I have to apologize to the people there because I must come off as like, you know, the most non-hippie person at the event. Like the, I don't know, what's the opposite of hippie? Redneck, I suppose. I mean, you know, there's people that are, you know, we talk about conservative and liberal, and I think hippie might be way left of liberal, And so I must appear to be extremely conservative in these hippie groups, but I do enjoy going, and I do enjoy so much. I've learned so much as a person going to these events. And granted, you got to kind of walk past some of the nutty people, to find the people that are the true gems and lovely and beautiful and wonderful in so many ways. When talking about how to grow a lemon tree outdoors, or some of the other practical aspects of permaculture, some of the techniques, then there are some people that tend to want to get distracted with, I don't know, you should love everybody and or something. So am I answering your question? I mean, it's like, so you're wanting some stories about hippie stuff.
That was good. It's just a funny little thing to end on. And I mean, I agree. I went to a primitive skills gathering. There was me and one other like survivalist there, and the rest of them were hippies. And I would say 99% were just amazing, skilled, awesome people. Practically like teaching their skills. There's a couple people doing permaculture, building, cob ovens, bamboo stuff, just all these amazing skills. And they were just wonderful people. And it's just sort of different, like, you know, before I started going down this path, I had, I don't know, bad preconceived notions about hippies. And then the majority of the ones I've met have been pretty awesome people, except for the ones, like you mentioned, that are just sort of mean, for lack of a better word.
There's some that are sort of mean, but there's some mean people in almost, you know, if we want to say hippies as a, I don't know, as a type of person maybe, then for every type that there is, there's going to be some mean ones. I think the ones that I struggle with most are the ones I call the tar babies.
Tar babies.
Yeah, it's like if you interact with them at all, it's like they just want to draw you into their life, and it's like, hey, can you give me a ride? And it's kind of like, so if you don't give them a ride, then they're going to be like, what's wrong with you? You're a horrible person. And, you know, and then it's like, if you do give them a ride, that'd be worse. So I don't know. There's certain, so yeah, the tar babies, it's kind of like, if you interact with them, you're going to be sad no matter what you do. And really the thing to do is run away. And it's like, that's one. So there's the tar, there's the hate in the name of love. There's mean people in all walks of life.
Everything.
And a big part of it is I think that, there are some people who build good things, build an amazing future for themselves as well as for others. But for every person that's a builder, there are 20 destroyers. And a lot of the destroyers, they don't even know that they're destructive. And usually how they destroy it is, what are you doing? What are you doing there? What's that? What are you doing there? Well, that's stupid. You shouldn't be doing that. You know, and that's just, that's one form of being a destroyer. You know, it's like,
yeah.
But this is just my experience. And I hope other people have better experiences than what I have in this space. But I believe here at Wheaton Laboratories, we're building a lot of new stuff, and I think we're pretty good at like not inviting the destroyers in. And every once in a while, one gets in, and we need to show them the door. But it's like some people build and some people destroy.
All right. Well, that's all I got. Do you have anything you want to talk about, Paul?
Well, actually, I've got to get going myself because here it's we're about to have lunchtime, and
awesome.
You respect the cook by showing up on time.
All right, I'll make sure I include links to Permies and the World Domination DVDs, which really look pretty awesome. I'm going to pick them up myself, at least the streaming ones. And well, thanks for coming back on the show, Paul.
Thanks, James. Talk to you later.
Bye.